This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Burundi's lawmakers have voted overwhelmingly to leave the ICC, and the president is expected to sign the bill. But some lawmakers warn the country is becoming dangerously isolated, and the opposition says the government's growing defiance of the United Nations and the international human rights groups is a sign that a neutral police force is needed.
That's Mohammed Yusuf reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Pope Francis spoke out strongly today for the protection of child migrants and an end to child slavery and prostitution. Libya's military leader still has not accepted an invitation to join the country's UN-backed government of national accord. And Nigeria's government says 21 girls kidnapped from the Chibok boarding school 2 years ago have been released by the militant group Boko Haram. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi's lawmakers have voted overwhelmingly to leave the ICC, and President Nkurunziza is expected to sign the bill. But some lawmakers warn the country is becoming dangerously isolated, and the opposition says the government's growing defiance of the United Nations and international human rights groups is a sign that a neutral police force is needed. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Burundi's National Assembly spent the better part of Wednesday debating and voting on a bill to withdraw from the International Criminal Court. The legislators overwhelmingly passed the bill, and the Senate also adopted the resolution. The bill now awaits the signature of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Only a handful of lawmakers voted against the bill or abstained from the vote, including Agathon Rwasa, Vice President of the National Assembly. The former president candidate says Burundi cannot afford to isolate itself from the rest of the world.
It is a matter of choosing. If one feels that what he does is positive for him, he must also think about the consequences. So let's just wait for any kind of impact of this kind of decision. All that I know is that Burundi is not an island. It is among the international community.
No country has ever withdrawn from the ICC, despite some countries in Africa threatening to pull out. Rights groups estimate that at least 450 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands forced to flee in the political violence that broke out after Nkurunziza decided to seek a third term last year. In September, UN investigators released a report looking into rights abuses in the country. The investigators documented hundreds of cases of summary executions, arbitrary arrests, torture and sexual violence, and accused the government and people associated with it to be behind much of the violence. Pankrins Chipanya is deputy spokesman for the political opposition now in exile, CINERED. He says civilians need to be protected.
It's a proof that things are going bad. It's a proof that they recognize that they made so much crime. And they're afraid of ICC. They're afraid of international justice. And they're responsible of all crimes in the special report. We are really concerned. The international community, especially the Security Council, must deploy soldiers to protect the Burundians.
In July, the UN Security Council approved the deployment of a 228-member police force to Burundi to end the violence and human rights violations. The government rejected the proposal. International law expert Rodney Ogendo says whether Burundi withdraws from the Rome Statute or not, the international community can respond and take action against any human rights abuses committed by the state.
A state can pull out of the International Criminal Court. And that is within their prerogative. The only thing that the state can't do is to use the fact that it is sovereign to shield itself from its international responsibility in ensuring that there is protection of the rights of the people.
United Nations spokesperson Stefan Dujarric said Wednesday that state parties that decide to withdraw are still obligated to cooperate with any criminal investigations or proceedings that were commenced before the withdrawal date. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohamed. As reported, Burundi's national parliament has voted to leave the International Criminal Court. What will the move mean, and is it easy to do? For answers to these questions, reporter William Eagle spoke with Mark Ellis, the executive director of the International Bar Association in London.
I think it was in some ways inevitable because the African Union has been very critical of the ICC, has in fact called on countries to withdraw. Under the Rome Statute, it is permissible to withdraw from the court's jurisdiction. So what Burundi is doing is not in any way illegal. It's also not a decision that will protect Burundi from the current investigation that is occurring by the ICC.
Why would it not? And would investigation findings carry any weight in Burundi if it withdraws from the Rome Statute?
Well, generally, because under the Rome Statute, the withdrawal takes effect 1 year after the date of receipt of the notification. And so once the UN Secretary General is notified, then the clock begins to tick, and it will be a year before the withdrawal officially takes place. But until that time, it doesn't in any way discharge the country's obligation under the Rome Statute. It's still, in essence, a party to the statute, and therefore any investigations that are occurring or could occur. The prosecutor could initiate additional proceedings during this year period. And let's remember that the court is only conducting a preliminary investigation. They haven't indicted anyone. The preliminary investigation is at the very start of the process. It's just allowing the prosecutor to look at evidence, collect evidence, do, in essence, a preliminary review to determine whether or not she wants to pursue a full indictment. And that can take a very, very long time, but it would not in any way prevent the court from continuing to pursue a full indictment since it has now initiated a preliminary indictment.
If the ICC, through its preliminary investigation, does come up with an indictment in years in the future, even if Burundi is no longer a signatory to the Rome Statute, it could potentially indict people and jail them or find them innocent, either way, despite the withdrawal of Burundi from the ICC?
The court doesn't have a police force. It doesn't have any enforcement mechanism. It relies on the cooperation of the state and the international community at large. And so far, we've seen that if you fail to get the cooperation of the state, then it's, again, very difficult to pursue any type of investigation. And the international community, including the UN Security Council, generally has been silent and has not stepped up. So I think if the withdrawal happens, even if the ICC pursues a case, then I think it's unlikely that you will, in fact, not only get an indictment, but have a transfer of the indictees to The Hague for a trial.
Does the head of the ICC or the Assembly of State Parties have anything to do with approving or disapproving of the move by states like Burundi who wish to leave?
There could be political pressure on Burundi from the international community, and particularly those states who have signed the Rome Statute and are state parties. I suspect that's where the pressure could come from to say to Burundi, this is a mistake. It sends out the wrong message. You shouldn't do that. But there's no enforcement mechanism either within the court nor, for instance, within the UN Security Council or the UN Assembly. It's a decision that the state makes on its own.
If Burundi does quit the Rome Statute and the ICC, what's left for investigating or punishing or trying any of these actors behind the violence there?
The option that still exists is the concept of universal jurisdiction. And universal jurisdiction says that there are some crimes that are so heinous that all countries have a responsibility to ensure that those who commit those crimes are brought to justice. And so that makes it difficult for individuals who are accused of committing these crimes to travel outside the country because they could be very fearful that they would be arrested under this universal jurisdiction concept.
That was Mark Ellis of the International Bar Association in London. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. Well, the leader of Ethiopia's opposition Oromo Federalist Congress says protests have spread across the country because people want to see real change, not empty government promises. But he says the government's recent announcement offers political reforms too little, too late. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
Insisting the demonstrations in Ethiopia's Oromia region during the past year are a mass movement, the chairman of Ethiopia's opposition, Oromo Federalist Congress, Merera Gudina, is calling for the government to listen to the people's demands.
Our struggle until a democratic state is created in the country, a political system that equally treats all the citizens of the country is created, we continue our struggle, whatever the cost may be.
He says the government has been using carrot and stick tactics. Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn has promised political reforms, which Gudina says are too little, too late. Desalegn also announced a 6-month national state of emergency to restore order. Recent violent protests have targeted mostly foreign-owned businesses, burning and damaging almost a dozen factories and flower farms and an estimated 60 vehicles across the Oromia region. An American researcher was killed near Addis Ababa when her car was attacked. Rights groups such as Amnesty International have accused security forces of using excess force to put down the protests. During the recent Thanksgiving celebration in early October, at least 55 people were killed in a stampede after police fired shots in the air and tear gas. In August, protests in the Oromia and Amhara regions left dozens dead and hundreds injured after Ethiopian security forces allegedly opened fire on unarmed anti-government protesters. Several requests by VOA for response from the Ethiopian communications minister were not answered. The research and monitoring manager at Transparency Group Publish What You Fund, Elise Dufieff, says frustrations must be turned into a constructive political force.
Because whenever violence occurs in that way, it gives another reason to the government to say, well, you see, these are destructive forces. We can't really have a discussion or a dialogue with them. Like, we can't have a constructive discussion to see how we can, to identify the way forward. So all we can do is reassert our authority and make sure that these people do not have a voice in the political sphere of the country. So that's not helping their case.
Dufieff adds that the protesters are trying these different tactics in the attempt to make their voices heard. But Gudina says protesters know what they want in the end.
Now people want real change, you know, real change on the ground, real change, the tangible things, you know, but not empty promises.
The protests began in November 2015 over a government plan to expand the boundaries of the capital, Addis Ababa. Issues have since expanded to include human rights, political representation, and political participation. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Jill. Well, Pope Francis spoke out strongly today for the protection of child migrants and an end to child slavery and prostitution. The Pope not only commented on Europe's migrant and refugee crisis, but displacement around the world. Reporter Josephine McKenna monitored the pontiff's speech. From Rome, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Well, this has been a very strong subject for the Pope, something that has really come through throughout his pontificate since he was elected in 2013. Pope Francis today spoke out in support of migrant children, minors who are travelling alone, escaping conflict and war and poverty, saying that they're incredibly vulnerable, as we know, to child prostitution, forced labour, human trafficking, and have no protection because they're very often travelling alone.
Josephine, how much influence does Pope Francis have in Europe, especially at a time when so many countries are closing their borders to migrants?
Well, this is a very important political message. He wants to influence political leaders. He wants to keep this kind of issue on the agenda, not only affecting child migration, but also encouraging political leaders, encouraging governments around the world, not only in Europe but elsewhere, to have an open mind to supporting migrants, accepting migrants, really taking care of child migrants, ensuring that they have access to education, that their rights under the International Convention on the Rights of the Child are protected, and really ensuring that they have a future And he's using this particular occasion ahead of the annual World Day of Migrants and Refugees, which will take place in January, to keep this issue on the agenda and to try and promote a more compassionate approach.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. The Nigerian government says 21 girls kidnapped from the Chibok boarding school 2 years ago have been released by the militant group Boko Haram. A military spokesman says the government freed four Boko Haram leaders in the exchange. The girls were released last night in the northeast city of Bangui on the Cameroon border. They were flown by helicopter to Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State, and are now in the custody of Nigeria's National Security Agency. A government spokesman says negotiations between Boko Haram and the government were brokered by the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Swiss government. The Nigerian president's office says negotiators will continue to work for the release of the remaining 167 girls who were abducted during a nighttime raid in April 2014. And in health news, the World Health Organization released its Global Tuberculosis Report today. It says the epidemic is bigger than previously estimated because of new data from India. There were 10.4 million new infections in 2015. Six countries accounted for 60% of the new cases: India, Indonesia, China, Nigeria, Pakistan, and South Africa. The new infections include 580,000 cases of multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. On the positive side, the WHO says the number of TB deaths and the incident rate continue to fall. Dr. Mario Ravaglioni is director of the WHO's Global TB Program. He says despite some positive news, response to the disease is still lagging.
We estimate around, and this is the new estimate here, 49 million lives having been saved since the year 2000, with over 3 million of them just in the last 1 year. However, the gains we have made are at risk, and I'm sad to report that the overall progress in adopting a new and innovative attitude in the fight against tuberculosis has been, if you allow me, dismal. I would have expected much more after the 2014 resolution at the World Health Assembly by the Ministers of Health, and also after the pledge made within the context of the Sustainable Development Goals. I don't see that movement coming through. We are going at the same pace as before.
The number of people dying from tuberculosis has fallen by 22% between 2000 and 2015. Nevertheless, at least 1.4 million people still die from the disease every year.
As a result of this, tuberculosis is now back among the top 10 causes of death worldwide. It is really a concerning issue that in 2016 we have to face for a curable disease, a number of deaths which is as devastating as 5,000 per day.
The WHO official raises concerns about multidrug-resistant TB.
So regarding this MDR-TB situation, we keep calling it a crisis, and a crisis that unfortunately is not being taken seriously enough. Among the new TB cases, an estimated 3.9% had multidrug-resistant TB, a level that appears essentially unchanged compared to previous years. In reality, we have 580,000 people that require second-line regimen, second-line treatment. That's why we call it a crisis. Once we look at how many of these 580 estimated cases of MDR-TB or rifampicin-resistant TB are actually diagnosed and placed on treatment, we find that about 80% are simply not diagnosed.
That was Dr. Mario Ravaglioni, director of the World Health Organization's Global TB Program. Well, Libyan military leader Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar still has not accepted an invitation to join the country's UN-backed government of national accord. Haftar has said Libya needs a leader with strong military experience and has praised Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He currently commands Libya's national army. Najla el-Mangush was a senior member of Libya's National Transition Council. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed el-Shanawi about Haftar's political views.
I will disagree with him that we need military experience to rule the country. We need a person who can see that as a part of the leadership, but we don't want to have a military country. We want to have really a country that's based on the foundation of real democracy, engaged in respect to the rule of law. But I think also I can see his point coming from the perspective of military experience. He thinks that the only solution to sustainable peace and security in Libya by fighting and by using power and weapons. That could be true in some situations, but I disagree with him in terms of we need this kind of leadership to control our country. No, because the military strategy or vision is very limited, and they see the power as a tool of peace. And that, I think, is problematic, because you need the military power to sustain respect and stability. But also you need this kind of diplomacy and relationship and peace-building work and security aspect to be part of this big task.
What's your prescription for a political solution in Libya?
I've been there and I've been part of this movement, and I can see there were a huge potential to take this initiative and to be more successful and more grounded. What really Libya is missing now is the quality of good leadership that understand the complexity and the history and the narrative of the Libyan people. Person who can really bring the people together, because we have a lot of things that can bring everybody together. We have history, we have one language, we have one religion. Yes, we have the diversity within our, but we are a very small population. It's very easy to bring the people together, to share this sense of identity. Leadership is a big part of it, but I think also part of it is how to really try to structure the society in a way that could include, you know, the locals, the grassroots level, the civil society, the unions, the local council. Local council is very, very important in Libya. Libya, it's a big, big country with a small population, and in order to control and sustain type of security and stability, the local council is significant for the Libyan today. Asking here for division, no, we want one Libya, but we want system that could works well. And I think the federal system for Libya during the kingdom era was very successful in terms of trying to navigate and serve the people needs. And then under one umbrella, which is either kingdom or democracy or whatever the people want.
Najla el-Mangush was a senior member of Libya's National Transitional Council. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed el-Shanawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou will discuss health awareness in Africa and how it empowers the people to better care for their well-being. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202 619-3111. Let's chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical journey. I guarantee.